This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dafrin Johan. Amnesty International released their annual human rights report yesterday, and as expected, things appear to have gone from bad to worse on a global scale, no thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic. Selfish or seemingly selfish and sometimes even racist responses to the pandemic, as well as escalating conflicts, political turmoil, and humanitarian crisis in many parts of the world. When we zoom in Malaysia, things aren't looking too great either. So joining me on the show today to discuss all of this is Katrina Jorin Mariomau. She's the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Katrina.
Thanks so much, Ashwin, and thank you so much for giving us the space to take a look at the year that has just passed and also figure out, I guess, how we move on from there to look at some of our global realities, even as we live through the experiences and reflect on Malaysia.
So let's get into it. From 2020 up until now, the world has been hit with the biggest health and economic crisis in the past 20 to 40 years. I think most people will agree with that. And I'm talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. In the wake of that, we've heard phrases like build back better, global reset, opportunity, etc., etc. Katrina, did countries around the world, especially when we look at the superpowers, the likes of the US, the EU, China, did they practice what they preached?
Yeah, so at the start of the pandemic, we certainly did see these proclamations of how this is an opportunity for a global reset. In this time of incredible loss and trauma, we could perhaps reimagine and reshape the world we're in. There certainly was, and I think still is, the opportunity to do that. Yet, what we received from governments and corporate global leaders were the twin arms of false promises and greed and collusion. So, for example, you know, at the G7 and G20 summits, in national forums, political leaders paid lip service to policies to, quote unquote, build back better, as you said. You know, they talked about a fairer post-pandemic world. And it is what we needed. It's still, you know, very much what we need to do to put forth policies that, you know, that will address the deep-seated inequalities that we saw more clearly than ever in the pandemic. You'll remember the pledges made by many governments, especially rich countries, to share COVID-19 vaccines with poorer parts of the world. You'll remember maybe tech giants and big pharma talk about quote-unquote corporate social responsibility. But what was the reality? You know, what we saw was that wealthy states like the EU and the UK block attempts to remove intellectual property barriers that would help scale up vaccine production. What we saw was big pharma lobby aggressively against proposals to temporarily waive intellectual property rights. So, for example, in June 2021, the WHO established the mRNA vaccine technology transfer hub in South Africa so that African manufacturers could make mRNA vaccines like those of Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna. But those companies have refused to participate. And then we see the consequences of this. So like in countries like in South Africa, again, right, where we've had 750,000 children drop out of school, three times the pre-pandemic levels. And so these are some of the effects, not just of the pandemic, but by the greed of rich countries and big pharma, which could have very much enabled vaccine production and availability. I think within this also, you know, pharmaceutical companies have received billions in public funding, yet those companies continue to put their own greed before their human rights responsibilities. So, for example, in 2021, Pfizer and Moderna projected a ridiculous profits of up to $54 billion, that's with a B, right, US dollars. Yet they supplied less than 2% of their vaccines to low-income countries. Chinese companies Sinovac and Sinopharm delivered only 0.5% and 1.5% respectively of their vaccines to low-income countries. So again, you know, to reiterate, political leaders and corporate titans have really colluded to put profit and power ahead of people and have betrayed the promises for a fair recovery that they've made. every opportunity we've had to, you know, deal with the systematic inequalities, instead that they have taken the wrong turn, they've undercut vaccine successes, and really they've just driven deeper the inequality already faced by the most marginalized.
We talk about COVID, we talk about greed. I also want to talk about the rise of authoritarianism, because the report also indicates that governments use COVID-19 as an opportunity to further reduce civic spaces and clamp down on dissent. Walk us through this, Katrina.
So I think, you know, some of the criticism is that, oh, yes, when you're facing a pandemic, you know, there are restrictions that have to be in place. And I do think, you know, there is a difference between taking measures for public health and using the pandemic to clamp down on dissent, shut down democratic processes, stunt access to justice, stifle media freedom. You know, for example, just thinking human rights defenders, right, including those working in the field of research, health, social care, journalism, and others, have been so fundamental in informing the public about the challenges posed by COVID-19 at all stages of the crisis.
Right.
You know, their work has been essential, right, in ensuring that states provide accessible and reliable information in a fair and transparent manner. And so governments have to respect the role that all of these individuals play. Governments must be accountable, and they must be open to scrutiny, as well as providing evidence-based and accurate information for all of their decisions. But, you know, when we're in this period right now, where it is this monumental, devastating global crisis, when we need independent voices to critique, to collaborate, to think together, to develop solutions, what we saw instead globally was governments deploying a widening gamut of tools and tactics to crush down on dissent. And so, you know, human rights defenders, NGOs, media outlets, opposition leaders globally have been targets of unlawful detention, torture, enforced disappearances, and many of this being done under the smokescreen of the pandemic.
Right.
From our report, at least 67 countries introduced new laws globally in 2021 to restrict freedom of expression, association, or assembly. In Malaysia, and we will certainly talk about that a little later, we saw some of these restrictions. In Afghanistan, after the Taliban took over, more than 200 media outlets were shut down. In Hong Kong, as a result of the threats by the national security law, at least 61 civil society organizations were disbanded. In the US, at least 36 states introduced more than 80 pieces of draft legislation to limit freedom of assembly. In Russia, the government turned to facial recognition to undertake arrests of peaceful protesters. In the UK, the government proposed the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, which would drastically curtail freedom of peaceful assembly and expand police powers. And in Africa, you know, authorities in Congo and Niger and Zambia and elsewhere have used criminal defamation laws to intimidate and muzzle critics.
You know, the thing is, like, defenders of this whole law and order approach to governance argue that a situation like COVID-19 requires a quote-unquote firmer approach to governance, and countries where civic spaces are huge ended up seeing large-scale anti-mask, anti-vaccine, anti-lockdown protests compared to countries with relatively smaller civic spaces, such as in China or even Singapore. How would you respond to people who bring up this argument?
Right. So I think, I mean, the level of protest that we're seeing in different places, part of it could be in terms of the how loose or restrictive the freedom of expression and assembly laws are. Part of it also, I think it's a bit more complex looking at the dynamics of how misinformation is also being spread. And actually, the Amnesty report does cover talking about the role of big tech. So it wasn't just, you know, big pharma that were the only corporate giants that undermined pandemic recovery efforts. You also saw big tech and sort of this the way the algorithms work, right, that often prioritizes sensational content and that drives a lot of profit for big tech. That has really provided like a really fertile ground for COVID-19 misinformation and has allowed sort of a lot of these, whether it's masking measures, whether it's vaccine hesitancy, to really flourish. And so I think there is a real responsibility there for tech companies also to look at their platforms and how their platforms have been used for anti-vaccine, anti-COVID-19 measures, conspiracy theories, and how that has led to some of the protests that, you know, seem to go against public health and healthcare measures. Right. I think that, you know, that space of, again, like I said earlier, about how you, yes, there will be times when there are, you know, restrictions that that are needed to happen. But the manner in which that is done, I think in many places, so for example, you have, if people are coming out in a way that is taking into account the restriction guidelines, if they are in social distancing, if they're wearing their masks, for example, and in that context, you crack down on them for expressing dissent, saying that they are threatening public harm, while at the very same time, you know, shopping malls are open, people are being asked to go to work. You know, there is definitely a disconnect. And so I think in Malaysia, we certainly live through that reality. It is not so much that these measures of restrictions are being taken solely for public health. We're seeing them used and wielded specifically when it goes against the interests of the state. And we also see how this is being used differently, right? So in Malaysia, the use of antara dua darjat as a way to talk about when these restrictions are applied and to whom. I think all of that really, if you take that bigger picture look, you'll see that we looking at there is a very serious usage of what should be minimal and thoughtfully used restrictions as a way to really undermine our freedom of expression and dissent.
In many countries, the primary worry over the past couple of years, you know, even in Malaysia to a large extent, has been COVID-19. However, in many other countries, it wasn't just COVID that was ravaging them, but conflicts and war as well. We're talking about the likes of Yemen, Afghanistan, Palestine, Myanmar. Now, in the case of Myanmar, it's caused by internal political conflict. In many other countries, it's a mixture of internal and external forces, such as the EU and US invasions and whatnot. What have been the consequences of these conflicts?
It has been devastating. You know, as you rightly point out, in many parts of the world, COVID-19 isn't the sole crisis that entire countries are being slammed with. There has been an utter failure of the global community, particularly states in positions of power, to deal with the multiplication of conflicts around the world. So we have new and we have unresolved conflicts that have erupted, and that has led to millions of people being displaced, killed, subjected to sexual violence. And it has brought already fragile healthcare and economic systems to the brink. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what human rights defenders have been saying from the start is that the pandemic is not just creating new crises, but it's compounding deeply entrenched inequalities and revealing, you know, how fractured the systems we have in place to address them are. So, you know, the report will go into greater detail, and I strongly urge your listeners to go to amnesty.org for the full report. But to give you a snapshot, right, of some of the crises. So, in Asia, in Afghanistan, so after the aftermath of the Taliban takeover, the already precarious humanitarian situation has deteriorated further due to conflict, due to drought, due to COVID-19, due to the economic crisis. In December, there were some 23 million people who are facing acute food insecurity and hunger, including more than 3 million children who are at risk of death from severe malnutrition. In Syria, between June and August of 2021, the escalation of hostilities in northwest Syria has led to nearly 100,000 people fleeing their homes. In Africa, the conflicts have displaced millions, and yet the humanitarian and security situations for refugees and internally displaced people in camps remain precarious. You know, the Ethiopian government, for example, has only allowed 10% of humanitarian aid intended for Tigray to enter, which has resulted in starvation.
Right.
You know, there are 5 million people that are in need of emergency food assistance. So all of this, I mean, this is just a tiny snapshot of what's going on around the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think the point that I want to get across, and the report also makes quite strongly, is that it's also the global failure to address these multiplying conflicts, which has provoked even greater instability and devastation. And the ineffectiveness of the international response to this crisis is most evident with the paralysis of the United Nations Security Council. The UN Security Council has failed to act on atrocities in Myanmar, on human rights violations in Afghanistan, in war crimes in Syria. And all of this shameful inaction, right? And this, again, paralysis of these multilateral bodies and the lack of accountability of powerful states has also led and paved the way for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which is in flagrant violation of international law.
Right. So, you know, we've only scratched the surface here, but things aren't looking too great on the global level. We are going to be zooming in on Malaysia specifically. We'll get to that after the break, Katrina. But before we get into that, some closing thoughts from you. What should nations, especially superpowers, do moving forward? And, you know, when we look at the state of the world right now, do you see a sense of hope? Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yes. So there are three things that sort of Amnesty is zeroing down on. I mean, and we will have in the report, there are more specific recommendations for different mm-hmm. regions. But broadly, if we look at COVID-19, for example, states and pharmaceutical companies should ensure equal access to COVID-19 vaccines, including by supporting a full TRIPS waiver that includes vaccines, tests, and treatments, with richer countries in particular needing to redistribute surplus COVID-19 vaccines to lower income countries. Pharmaceutical companies should prioritize deliveries where they are needed the most and share their knowledge and technology. This is not an impossible ask. Social media companies must also take concrete action to address the dissemination of false or misleading information. And this may mean adjusting their business models to ensure that human rights are respected. Secondly, I think we need to look at the UN. So Amnesty is calling to say that there needs to be a reform of the UN, the United Nations, including its response to global security and human rights crisis. And this is long overdue. The UN Security Council must no longer be allowed to advance political interests above protecting the lives, safety and rights of civilians. The abuse of veto powers also must end, especially when, you know, there is a need for collective action to stop atrocities. And finally, thirdly, governments have to fulfill the obligation to all people seeking international protection. This means a protection to refugees and to asylum seekers. You know, we have seen in the last few months, the last month plus, how governments have acted quickly and decisively to welcome and protect refugees fleeing the conflict in Ukraine. And that's excellent. You know, that's what we need. But now what we need is the governments applying these same standards when mm-hmm. dealing with people fleeing crises from different parts of the world. I also will say broadly that I am never without hope. And I think that the people's resistance, the people's movements, the willingness of people to come forth and to keep holding the state to meet their obligations for human rights, people banding together to support each other, I think that's where a lot of hope is. And I hope that, listeners who are listening to this, who will read the Amnesty report, don't move away feeling defeated, because I think, you know, and we certainly see here the immense power of people's movements and how that can really shift things even when it seems impossible.
All right, let's go for a very quick break. On the show with me today is Katrina Jorin Maliamau. She's the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. After the break, we'll be honing in on Malaysia specifically. So keep it here on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Katrina Jorin Maliamau. She's the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. Now, before the break, we spoke about human rights on a global level. Now we're going to be zooming in on Malaysia. Katrina, what does the Amnesty report say about us and where we are today? Are things looking really bad? Did we do better or worse than the previous year, and why?
So in summary, the report on Malaysia spotlights the targeting of human rights defenders, journalists, opposition leaders, and others who investigated, arrested, and prosecuted for criticizing the government. We also highlighted how the government has used COVID-19 measures to restrict freedom of expression and assembly, as I talked about a bit about earlier. And we listed out sort of the high number of custodial debts that are being recorded, but with no one being held to account, and the continued discrimination against Indigenous persons, refugees, migrants, and LGBTI persons. All of this set against the landscape of what has been a monumentally difficult time economically, psychosocially, that people have had to endure as a result of the pandemic and the poor responses to it. What we saw clearly also, and is reflected in the report, is that political jostling and maneuvering really dominate 2021. And I feel like I don't have to tell people in Malaysia what this is, right? But as a result of kind of political interest of the people in power being put as a priority, the governance and people's well-being has been ignored. And again, you know, COVID-19 measures have been used to restrict freedom of expression, but elite political leaders have continued to violate restrictions with no consequence. We also saw human rights reforms grind to a halt. You know, we were in a state of emergency from the beginning of 2021 to August 2021, and that led to the suspension of parliament and state legislative assemblies. We've not seen progress in the abolition of the death penalty, although the government is meant to review the mandatory death sentences this year. But even then, you know, it's so difficult to learn what the progress is. There has been not just a lack of review of existing laws that restrict freedom of expression, like the Sedition Act and Communications and Multimedia Act. We've seen increased usage of it. And despite, you know, really strong public outrage over police violence, custodial deaths, and the absolute need for an independent oversight of the police, what we have seen is instead the government threatening to table a weak, ineffective, and frankly insulting IPCC bill.
Now, Amnesty International's report highlights a clamping down of freedom of expression and freedom of the press throughout the pandemic. Walk us through this and the consequences of this.
So we've spoken, you know, about this several times in the show, and, you know, BFM has done a really good job of talking about the restrictions and freedom of expression. And I think what we've seen is that, and what we've experienced, so many of us, is this is how we are being squeezed out of public space. You know, how people in Malaysia are increasingly being muzzled and silenced. I remember going through weeks and weeks last year where there were reports of, you know, this journalist or that activist or this artist or that opposition leader being hauled in for questioning. Or there will be a small news article about, you know, some regular ordinary citizen who posted something critical about the government in their social media and is now being investigated under the Communications and Multimedia Act. So the report highlights some of this. We are unable to capture all of it, just, you know, the practicalities of word counts and all of that. But some of the things that we did spotlight, some of the examples we spotlighted was, for example, the Lawan protest and the very heavy-handed response they received. So Sara Erdina, for example, a youth activist, was arrested and investigated under the Sedition Act. The police went to the homes of protest organizers. On the day of the protest, you know, the surveillance and high presence and high police presence, you know, is also quite a show of intimidation. And then, of course, there was the investigation into the protest organizers after the fact. Listeners may also remember the vigil that was held, where people came together to mourn the high number of COVID-19 deaths that we were seeing. And the police response was to drag away vigil participants and investigate the organizers. We also saw, you know, individuals speaking up or reporting on migrants and refugees are being questioned. So, for example, activist Heidi Kwa was charged last year for a Facebook post that she made, an old Facebook post on the conditions of immigration detention centers, which has been so widely reported on for how horrifying they are. You know, we saw how opposition MPs were blocked from entering parliament and then subsequently fined and called in for questioning. Artist Fahmy Reza, whose art has been so critical in reflecting you know, people's critiques of the government on the realities we are facing, he has been repeatedly harassed and investigated, and now he's been charged for his art. The independent news outlet Malaysia Kini was fined ₹500,000 for contempt of court for readers' comments. And I think, I mean, these are just, like I said, some of the examples, but the overall effect of that has been really just not just a shrinking civic space. It's been this climate of fear that is being fostered. And like I said at the start of the show, right, this is a time, you know, in critical moments of crisis, we need independent voices. We need people coming together collectively. We need the government to feel like they are being held accountable. They need to feel that they need to be responsible for the decisions they make. And so it is incredibly alarming that what we experience instead is this shutting down, the silencing, and the censorship.
Right. Now, earlier in the first half of the show, Katrina, we talked about the seriousness of the global refugee crisis that is ongoing right now. We know that as a result of this refugee crisis, many displaced people come to our shores as well. We're talking about refugees from Myanmar, from Palestine, from Afghanistan, and the list goes on and on. What has been the state's, and I mean talking about the Malaysian government's, response to the refugees that have set foot on our shores?
So the Malaysian government still refuses to develop a comprehensive refugee policy. The government still continues to deny refugees and asylum seekers in Malaysia their fundamental human rights. So what does this mean? It means that refugees and asylum seekers in Malaysia, they're denied everything from their right to work, so right to earn a safe, decent living. The children can't go to school. They don't have the right really to live without violence, because as somebody who's effectively classified as being undocumented in Malaysia, it's very risky and difficult to seek redress and justice. They face the constant threat of arrest and detention. And we saw this, right, with the immigration raids that have that happened. Also within this context, and, you know, listeners may not be familiar with the fact that in the past, when refugees were arrested and put in immigration detention, the sort of only way out was if UNHCR, the UN body that is in charge of refugees, they would go in and they would determine that, you know, X and Y person is a refugee, and then they will try and secure their release from detention. Because, you know, you'll understand that if you're a refugee, you cannot be sent back to where you're from, because right, the risks and, you know, death, of torture, of persecution. But in Malaysia, since August of 2019, the government has denied UNHCR access to detention centers, which means that refugees, including children, including babies, have been locked up in indefinite detention for now at least 2 years, but a lot more than that, because they would have been detained before August 2019. Listeners may also remember that last year, the government deported 1,086 people back to Myanmar in February in the midst of a military coup in Myanmar, and they deported them in defiance of a court order. I know your question was sort of on the government's response specifically to refugees, but I think it's important also for us to be reminded that last year and in 2020, what we saw was a real increase in very hateful anti-migrant, anti-refugee, right, rhetoric. So a lot of racism, a lot of xenophobia that came directly from state actors or was enabled by them. And that has led to an increase in the discrimination and exclusion of migrants and refugees, particularly the Rohingya, from community areas, you know. So we've been seeing posts, banners, you know, where people are refugees or Rohingya or foreigners not allowed in restaurants, in mosques. And also the government has played up on this racist sentiments and have really used migrants, refugees as scapegoats for high COVID infection rates. And you know, it's a classic case of diverting the attention away from their own state's failures to respond effectively to the crisis.
Right. And what would you say to Malaysians who, and we hear this all the time, right? Because I've noticed on Facebook comments and social media posts and whatnot, where people are also attacking activists like Heidi Kwa, for example, or any other activists, human rights defenders who come up and speak up on behalf of the refugees, on behalf of migrant workers, speak up and say, no, the government needs to do enough. But then you have Malaysians who will come and say, oh, why are you defending them? You know, we aren't even doing enough for Malaysians. Malaysians are suffering. You want to bring in the refugees. You want to accept them and put them in your house. You know, you adopt them. And, you know, you have all these kinds of, like you rightfully use the word, xenophobic sort of statements. But what would you say to Malaysians who have this mindset?
I think that people are speaking from a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety and uncertainty. And this isn't to excuse racism or xenophobia. Mm-hmm. But I think that we've been trained in Malaysia to believe that human rights are finite, that if you have rights, then that means somebody else's rights needs to be sacrificed. But that is in complete opposition to what fundamental rights are. Fundamental rights, human rights exist because the principle of it is that I have rights because you have rights. And as soon as you start to allow governments to say, okay, maybe human rights are not, we won't protect them for this group, or you don't get those rights, or you in this condition, you won't have your rights, then the complete idea of human rights starts to get degraded, right? And we will see, if you let governments infringe it for this community, most likely than not, they're going to come for the next community. And so that's the first thing that I want to say. Our rights and our lives and our realities are connected to each other. If you have a government go to a society and say, okay, in this community, so maybe I'll take a step back and see an example that happened in Penang last year, where the Home Minister had gone to this particular community where Malaysians were very angry that there were refugees and living there. And they, in that community, and they were saying that the migrants and the refugees were to blame for job losses, for high drug usage, and so forth. Now, it could very well be the case that in that neighborhood, in that community, people are really struggling to survive. But the fact that there are not enough jobs, or jobs are not paying well enough, or unable to sustain you, the fact that you're not getting the canned support you need from your government isn't the doing of refugees and migrants. It is the state's responsibility, the government's responsibility, to ensure that everybody within their borders is taken care of. So what if we looked at it this way and we said, okay, in this community, we have individuals who are drug dependents. We have individuals who are suffering the trauma of war and seeking refuge. We have people who have lost their parents because of the COVID-19 pandemic. There's clearly a need for us to invest in this community in both psychosocial help, economic help. If you invest in spaces and communities that way, everybody benefits. You know, if we took away some of the funds and money that we put into punishing, into detaining, into cracking down, and instead diverted those funds to upholding human rights, everybody benefits. And so I think, you know, I'd really urge people to go beyond sort of those spaces of fear, and to recognize that really you are fighting the wrong enemy. You know, it is not people in situations of desperation that you need to be targeting. You need to be looking, as we said at the start of the show, at leaders, at corporate leaders, political leaders who are making decisions based on their own greed and profit and power. And if that's where we diverted our energies and our focus, then we have significant changes for all.
Absolutely. Something else that civil society has been screaming about, and rightfully so, is death in police custody and detention centers. How alarming are the stats, Katrina, as far as death in police custody and detention centers are concerned?
You know, the question of, like, even starting at the framing of what the statistics are really reminds me that in Malaysia, we have a critical issue where there is just a lack of transparency on data, full stop. So any statistics that we have that we can give, I think we need to couch that within the fact that there isn't often any clear reporting, no disaggregated data, no regular reporting. So when we hear about custodial deaths, and this is certainly true in 2021, right, it's often what is picked up by the media, or which the family reported to an NGO, or sometimes we will get information in parliamentary replies.
Right.
So I think that context is really important. Now, in 2021, we saw that at least 19 people died in police custody or shortly after release. I mean, certainly the story of Ganapati, you know, really captured a lot of people's anger and emotions. But there were just there's just a lot within that. And what we are getting though is the government saying, "Oh, we are investigating. Investigations are being done." But then what happens after that? You know, who is being held accountable? What is the repair and justice for victims and their families? And even within the investigations, there isn't an independent entity that is doing this. And so this is why civil society has been for at least 16 years pushing for the IPCMC, the Independent Police Complaints and Misconduct Commission. And there was, you know, this whole process about 16 years ago, where there was a Royal Commission of Inquiry looking into it, this massive report was submitted to the government. And now it's been, you know, you're coming to almost two decades of this constant push. And instead, what we've gotten is, like I mentioned earlier, a very weak IPCC bill, which is not independent, ineffective, and will dilute even the meager measures that we have right now. Additionally, I want to say that it's not just what happens after someone dies or after somebody was tortured. What we need is also a change in the culture and practices and policies that lead to the alarming deaths. In 2022, you know, we are just barely finishing the first quarter of 2022, and we've known 13 deaths in custody, I believe. And so I think, I mean, I haven't even gotten to detention centers.
Right.
The statistics on detention centers that came out in Parliament recently, there was a parliamentary question. What they said was that between 2018 and 15th of February 2022, 208 people died in detention. But again, that's such an odd way to frame it. Why can't you give us the numbers of how many people died in 2021 and in 2020? You know, there's it's this lack of clarity, the lack of breakdown on data, the reasons for deaths in custody and detention. It is so opaque. And I think that, you know, there has been a real anger and frustration from the public. We will keep pushing very hard for this, because the last thing that we want is these half-baked, weakened measures. And really what we need is we are beyond time for something that's really holistic, independent, well-funded, well-resourced, and effective.
All right, Katrina, before we wrap this conversation up, and I want to urge listeners to go and check out the full report, because we are just scratching the surface here. The report really dives into detail, and you can really see, you know, the real state of human rights in the globe and in Malaysia right now. But Katrina, before we wrap this conversation up, do you have some final thoughts? Anything else you'd like to add about the situation in Malaysia, or just a final message that you'd like to leave us with?
I think the final message I want to leave you with is that 2021, you know, it should have been a year of healing and recuperation. Instead, it became an incubator for deeper inequality and greater instability. And the legacy of that is going to be devastating for years to come. But as I also said earlier, despite that, we are seeing greater people's resistance. We're seeing people being able to articulate, even in spaces where they are so silenced, the world that we want. We see a lot of expressions of hope. And I think for Malaysians, we are exhausted. People have had to deal with so much, grief and loss and trauma and pain and anxiety. Not just from COVID, but everything that the pandemic and the political instability has exacerbated. But I also want to remind us that we have found ways to come together to support each other. I think we should hold hope that we can and should keep making demands for the kind of world that we want. There is more than enough resources within Malaysia. There is what we need to think about is how we allocate it or reallocate it. And also finally, really truly believe in the fact that we have fundamental rights. These are not distant visions or dreams in the clouds that we cannot reach. These should be the foundations on which we build our responses to any crisis and into the world that we want to create. Thank you again so much, Darshan. And again, for listeners, please go to amnesty.org for the full report.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Katrina. That was Katrina Jorin Maliomau. She's the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can also check us out on podcasts. We are available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.